One of the things that ministers are go to theological school to learn to do is something called exegesis. Exegesis is when you take a text and you look at its background and you try to say what it's all about and all that. So I'm going to do an exegesis of 550. So you, like good back in the day when congregations got together, they all took out the Bible. You take out the hymnal and go to 550 in the back and look at We Belong to the Earth, number 550. Number 550 in the hymnal. And this is, it's in the hymnal. Now, sometimes people will tell me, Clyde, I hear that Noah Seath didn't write that. And it's right. You're absolutely right. He didn't write this. First of all, he didn't write. Second of all, he didn't speak English, so he didn't write in English. Okay, no way did he write this. I think I'll write a responsive reading for the Unitarians. No. So you got your basic exegetical fact there. This text is oral tradition. And as oral tradition, he said about something that is contained in a letter where he's protesting a treaty which goes on for maybe 9 or 8 pages of your standard double space type of, you know, manuscript. It's a longer letter than's contained here. So somebody in their wisdom decided to take some interesting passages from the English translation of Noah Seath's long letter, because you have to translate it if you're going to write a letter to the Congress in the United States saying your treaty isn't what I would have written if I were to write a treaty. You have to write it in English because they don't do the indigenous language. So that's what you got here. But it's pretty good anyways. And they did it and they take it. And since in most of the people who you call Indians, American Indians, indigenous peoples of North America, don't speak each other's language, and there are about 500 of them, we actually communicate with each other in English or French or Spanish. And therefore, we are familiar with the English translation of his letter. So let us begin. I will read the Roman, and you will read the italics. This we know, the earth does not belong to us, we belong to the earth.
This we know, all things are connected, like the blood which unites our family.
All things are connected. We do not weave the web of life. We are merely a strand in it.
Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves.
By the way, y'all, I expect you all know, Noah Seath is who the city of Seattle is named for. Seattle, Seath. So they didn't quite know how to pronounce Seath. So, yeah. And that's the... Sometimes they'll say Chief Seattle. Like all indigenous people who write letters are chiefs. Okay. There's a haunting scene in Zora Neale Hurston's important novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. One afternoon, the protagonist, Janie, sees large groups of Seminole Indians passing through the swamp heading east. They warn of a hurricane coming, but no one believes them. Stupid Indians, they yell. That night, the great Okeechobee hurricane struck, killing 3,000 people in what remains one of the most devastating natural disasters in the history of the United States. The Seminoles had read the tall grass in the swamps near Lake Okeechobee, where the lake opens up to that river of grass known as the Everglades. They observed the seed pods of the grass swell and pop open. And they began to leave the area, moving to higher ground. The Seminoles said the tall grass spoke to them as it had spoken to their ancestors for thousands of years. The tall grass spoke to them for generations of experience in living in Florida. They learned how their ecology behaved and how their ecology responded to different weather patterns. That experience taught them that a hurricane was coming. And that experience with hurricanes convinced them to evacuate to higher ground. That was 1928, before Doppler radar, before mathematical models, and how our scientific culture has learned to be so good about, oh, there's a hurricane coming, because you could sort of see it with that, all those signals going out into those storms. But they had no instruments and no computers, but they did have indigenous wisdom. They had what you might call Seminole science. On the prairies west of the Missouri River, the Caddo and Wichita people built very, very large houses, bigger than this structure, made out of grass with cedar frames, low to the ground. And seen from a distance, you might think it's a mound, just a mound in the prairie. Some of those structures are big enough to host the whole village for dance ceremonies and for games. And though the community celebrates the sacredness of their community and enjoy their community and become community together through the reenactment of their being. And the grass houses are both breathable and waterproof. The Caddo and Wichita peoples have lived on the prairie for generations. And they experience all kinds of weather in that open environment. They knew about blizzard snows and the relentless sun of the summer. And they knew that the prairies can see tornadoes. Those big meeting houses stand up to tornadoes. And they resist the being crushed by the snow. And they learn from their environment, built a sustainable relationship to it. They did not go to architectural school. They had indigenous wisdom. Let the building be part of the prairie. Be part of the prairie, with the prairie, not against the prairie. With the prairie, not against the prairie, the wind will blow over. They practice Caddo and Wichita science. Let's move further west. Few people know that Phoenix, Arizona, is, and its surrounding suburbs, sits on one of the most extensive and sophisticated irrigation systems in the world. Now, I'm not talking about the present water-robbing system that has been set up in the desert and pulls water out of the rivers before they get to Mexico and devastates northern Mexico by that action. No, I'm not talking about those systems. What I'm talking about is a system that was built by the Hoboken people 2 centuries before the slave trader Columbus got lost in the Bahamas, where he and his crew were discovered by the Tianos, luckily, or we would never have been discovered. The Hoboken's irrigation system was a major irrigating engineering feat. The ancient canal system dates from the 5th and 6th centuries. According to the hegemonic Christian calendar, that's 5th and 6th centuries. And the building continued for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Just kept building this system. Thousands of miles of waterways were constructed, watering tens of thousands of acres of crops. You can imagine the population, all of that corn and beans, kale, and all that could support. The Pocan people returned the water from the, that it can flush through and irrigate it, and the water came back into the rivers from this system. And the Pocan people learned from their surroundings and built a viable technology that rose out of nature. And they continued, however, they continued to build and build and build and build to the point that they began to work against the river. Work against the river. And by the 12th century of the Common Era, they had built an urban community that had become unsustainable. Almost all urban communities that have ever been built become unsustainable. And the Hoboken civilization collapsed when it lost touch with its relationship with its environment, when it became arrogant with its accomplishments, when it began to forget where life came from, and began to ignore its own indigenous wisdom that had sustained it for 600-700 years. The Hokan people no longer exist as a people. They went the way of other urbanized cultures and peoples who ceased to listen to Mother Earth. They did not live within the limits imposed by the desert or the river. They forgot the practices that were given, had given their culture in the first place. For most of the time, human beings have lived on this planet. People have paid attention to the earth. And with those times that there people didn't pay attention to the earth, stuff happens. Most of the time people lived on the earth, they paid attention to the earth, they lived in a place, and that place provided for their needs by knowledge of that particular environment. They learned by experience how to create a sustainable economy by living in harmony with Mother Earth. She revealed her secrets to them in that place over time. The plants spoke to them. Let me repeat it in other words. Indigenous wisdom is particular to a location. It is the wisdom of people who have learned by experience to create a sustainable way of life, and that knowledge comes from practice over time. When we study Chinese villages, Japanese villages, villages in India and villages in Europe and Africa, we find the same reality. People living in a relationship to that environment, to that climate, to that way of being. And knowledge comes from practice over time. The ancient medical understanding of my ancestors, the Cherokees, was based on observing. Observing. This herb does provide relief for poison ivy. That one doesn't. But don't chew it or drink it in a tea. Those work for other herbs, but not for this one. Make a balm out of it and rub it on the rash. Medicine women kept the knowledge and trained their daughters. And the body of knowledge grew over time. Most pharmacology today, all those big corporations that are making money and charging you fortunes, I get all their knowledge from indigenous practices from Asia and Africa and North America and South America. The indigenous people taught all those PhDs all kinds of stuff because they had a lot of practice. So all the ancient herbalists whose treatments were often just as effective, if not more effective, than some today. And now we're coming to understand that the health of Native Americans, as well as other pre-industrial peoples in the world, Native Americans before the European invasion was excellent. They did not suffer from diabetes and cancer and heart attacks. Their diet were mostly vegetables. They had some meat, but they mostly vegetables, beans, greens, squashes, and whole grains. They got their exercise. And they lived healthy lives. They didn't eat just one food. They had dozens of varieties of what we would call corn or maize and other grains, and dozens of varieties of legumes and fruits and greens. And today, our commercial agriculture has generally reduced our choices. So unless you venture out and go to Whole Foods or one of those other kind of places and pay a premium or live near an organic farmer's market, you're basically restricted to what's on those shelves, and it's one variety of maize corn, and a couple of maybe three varieties of rices. And the food too many people eat is so circumscribed and the variety is quite limited. And it does not supply all the human nutritional needs that food once did. And if that weren't enough, American agricultural products are full of toxins. And our meats are full of antibiotics and growth hormones. These have been added to the process. There's some kind of way. When I was a child, and I'm sure I can see that some people are as old as me. When I was a child, there was these stores called day-old bread stores. Day-old bread stores. And what was a day-old bread store about? Well, they only kept the bread on the shelves for a day. Then they put it in the day-old bread store. Now they got these things called preservatives so they can keep the bread there for a long time. Long time on the shelves before you eat it. Well, that preservatives are really good for you, I'll tell you. So this isn't just about us and our health. This isn't just about Homo sapiens, which translates, I think, the monkey that thinks. No, there's a hidden problem with ignoring indigenous wisdom, the wisdom of accumulated over a couple of 100,000 years by our ancestors. There's a hidden problem. The way our food is grown and brought to us is also damaging the atmosphere. The way our food is grown and brought to us is eroding the soil and poisoning the precious water reserves. We can't continue to do that. Human beings, not so very long ago, lived in communities whose relationship to the earth was sustainable. But today the world is being drawn into a global economy and media civilization that inculcates ignorance of our relationship to nature. I actually have worked with children that are don't really understand where meat comes from. It's not from packages in the supermarket. So it forgets our ancient wisdom, it forgets this wisdom, and we are asked to trust in something called science. Science is observation of nature and learning from it and practicing what it teaches us. That's what I understand science to be. But we're not learning that much of the science that we are being sold is science in the service of corporations. Science that the PhDs are being bought and paid for. You can do this research, and if the research doesn't turn out good for the company, it doesn't get published. And it doesn't get taught to your grandmother and her daughters and her daughters and her daughters. So most Unitarian Universalists agree that there's a whole group of crises. A whole group of crises. But they have been taught that these crises are somehow outside of us. There's that crisis in the atmosphere, the crisis in the water table, the crisis, all this crisis is in the crisis in the, oh, you can name them. I bet you if we sat here, we could just drop lists, papers, little those pieces of paper, you all do that. And you put them on the wall and they'd just be full of crises. But I'm inviting you to think of, to consider that the crisis is us. That's us. That our human relationship to our life-sustaining environment in which we live and move and have our being is profoundly alien. Alien to who we are, who we were evolved to be, who we what gave us life in the first place. We've invented a way of living that's alien to being human. And therefore it's inhuman. We've been taught to call our crisis of relationship by all these different names, global warming, climate change, etc. And we know about world hunger and commercialization, agriculture. But they, all of those ways of looking at the crisis make them sound like they're out there. So if the crisis is a spiritual malaise, a crisis of relationship, a crisis of who we are, we have to start looking at how we think. Because how we think isn't we can't just buy a technology to solve our problem. So if they're not a bunch of isolated problems, solvable by isolating the problem and then finding out an expensive solution, but rather a profound alienation of who we are as human beings, then it comes back to what that responsive reading said, didn't it? It's that simple. I don't want to make it sound simple, but it's profoundly simple. We belong to the earth. The earth doesn't belong to us. We belong to the earth. The earth doesn't belong to us. Now, every now and then we make these words of Noah Seeth into an exotic saying. We something for Native American Indians Month heritage or wow. But everybody, wasn't just Native Americans understood this. Everybody understood this. Everybody understood this just not too long ago. Not too long ago. For Indians, is 10 generations. 10 generations. We've been Cherokee people, we have hundreds of generations and hundreds of generations. So, our economy, the one we live in, our social practice, our politics are all premised on the idea that the earth is a thing. All of our thinking is premised on the idea that the earth is a thing outside of us. To manipulate and violate as we will. And if we belong to the earth, or we can't at the same time believe that the earth is a thing. If we're children of the earth, if she's our mother, then we can't believe she's a thing. So if she's a thing and it belongs to us, we might well believe that all the problems are technological problems. All the problems can be solved with techniques. Hybrid cars and windmills and fluorescent light bulbs. Just enough techniques and they're expensive too, some of those. All the good things, but they won't address the root problem. If we come to live in this simple but profound reorientation, we can reclaim one by step by one by step. That's how spirituality works, right? One step by one step by one step. We can learn something which is the wisdom of our ancestors. The model of people who are alive today with us on this continent, the indigenous people, is that ancestral wisdom needs to be understood and cherished. That wisdom is based on generations of attentive interaction between human beings and the diversity of life. It's not some spirit that you catch with a dream catcher. You actually practice it over and over and over again until you learn those wisdoms. And it's found in concrete relationship to concrete ecosystems and environments. The wisdom informs us this earth is better understood as a complex interaction and processes that are involved in, and therefore we cannot stand outside of the process. There's no objectivity, really, if we belong to the earth. And we cannot isolate ourselves or reduce those processes to simplistic causes and effects. Consequently, an indigenous understanding of the environmental impact statements also looks at the big picture, sees ourselves in relationship to that picture, and sees it for a framework for generations. You have to think of what's going to happen to 7 generations down the road. What's that mall going to be? 7 generations on the road. So the indigenous understanding is that we belong to the earth leads to a deep appreciation that we stand on the shoulders of all that have gone before. And our ancestors live in us, that their wisdom informs us, and that we profit from the choices they made and the work they did and the knowledge they accumulated, and we suffer from the mistakes and missteps that our ancestors took too. And part of wisdom is living into the mistakes and finding new solutions. They didn't, that war thing they had, good. Therefore, because of that understanding, every decision we make, we must consider the generations that come, consider that the earth that they will belong to, that the earth that will sustain them, and consider the wisdom that will be their heritage, because that's what our ancestors did for us. 100 generations of grandmothers thought for us, and we must think for them, for our children. And when we come to know this in our depths, in our mind, in our body and spirit, that we belong to the earth, we will also come to live in an awareness of surroundings of the place we inhabit, the creatures, the water, the processes that my people call our relatives, our extended family of interdependence. We will live in a relationship with what has been and what has become and what is becoming in every moment of our now. And our humanity will heal with our earth, and our earth will heal with our humanity.